our help is, our people got up, how many people here are still working on Hummer One? That comes. Well, got break lecture off early and go to layout mode and kind of, I'll try to help you get started and everybody else through the rush nights, okay? Last meeting, which was our first meeting, we talked about cafeteria bid papers. Any questions about that? What I want to talk to you briefly about is your homework two assignment. Your homework two assignment is to create a prime number discovery program using the algorithm known as the sieve of Eratosthenes. So let me go over this. This is the model that all your assignment documents will follow pretty much. So it has a title, a due date, and I try very hard to keep that due date one on the calendar page. Just saying, you ever see a discrepancy there and inconsistency, be sure to let me know. You've got educational objectives, and they are to experience using bit vector objects and applications, experience using make files, organize, compile, multi-file applications. Your operational objectives, this is like the list of things you got to get done, right? You want to provide a client program whose file is named sieve.cpp. It's a client for the class FSU BitVector that implements the sieve of Eratosthenes algorithm to compute all prime numbers less than or equal to an input integer and provide a makefile to create an executable sieve.x. So your deliverables are two files, a sieve.cpp file and the make file. So the next thing I'm going to do is I'll try to file the policy, making sure the homework is a doable assignment prior to the assignment. So notice I just typed make. So after your submission, I should be able to do that in your submission portfolio folder for this homework. Make should do sieve.x, and sieve.x should make like this. Enter max, and it spits out the primes less than or equal to max. Notice that it's a very simple one shot. Right? You hit the up arrow key and do it again. That's your move. It's your finger on your right hand. Okay. That was 10. Try 100. 1,000. 10,000. I don't think it worked right though. Well, I'm surprised. It's basically a question of how many bits can you get into out of the bit vector. That implies I'm getting 100,000 bits, obviously, right? So I'm entering 100,000. So my bit vector for the sieve of Eratosthenes got 100,000 bits. 100,000 divided by 8 is what? 12,500 bytes. I guess that's still not too big. Okay. What was that last one? 100,000? Yeah. Oh. I think maybe. That's 100,000. Million is probably going to break, right?
Oh.
I've done something to make this work for
bigger
numbers.
This is what I'm
saying. Okay, so that's a million bit. That's a bit vector of size 1 million. Now, you try to make a vector of an int of size 1 million, I would guess that you would be refused on that. So, the point is a bit vector can store, has 8 times as many bits as the biggest vector you can make, the biggest array you can make. The point, I guess, is this is pretty fast. I think the time consumed here is the display time. This is one of my favorites, 50,000. Who knows what the largest prime less than 50,000 is? Less than 50,000. We know it's not 50,000. But it's one less, 49999. Anyway, so that's the way the sieve is supposed to play. A surprising thing is that this is important in applications because when we get to towards the end of the semester, we'll get to something called a hash table. And the internal structure of a hash table will require the computation of a prime number on the fly. And we'll be using the sieve of Eratosthenes to do that. So if you're kind of working on something that ultimately is going to be a part of something else that you've got to do in your next project. for that is, where else was it? Hey. So let's talk about the Civil Veritas and these algorithms. Everybody see it work pretty well? Idea is, I think I demonstrated this for you with the keyboard last time. Let me just get you to look at me, and let me see if I can hand wave you through it. So you're going to think of your bit vector as starting on, I'm behind the vector, you're in front of it. So the bit vector starts here and grows in this direction. Goes across from left to right, like positive numbers grow in the same direction. What you're going to do is take this bit vector and start off by, you can do it, of course, leave a 0 or 1. Yeah, okay, so we're set all of bits, meaning make all the bits equal to 1 in the whole bit vector. And we made this long enough so that there's an index for each number between 0 and the prime that you want to know, I mean the number, sorry, you don't know it's prime, but the number that gets entered by the user, you want bit 0 through that number in this bit vector. So that means that the number of the bit vector has to have size 1 greater than a number entered by you. Anyway, so you have this bit vector. You set all the bits equal to 1. And then what we're going to do is start clearing bits for the things that we know are not prime. You clear 0 because it's not prime. Clear 1, or unset. Unset 0, unset 1. Leave 2 set because we know 2 is prime. This is where we start out our looping. So 2 is prime. So you start a loop at this point. You clear 0, clear 1. Your loop is for the outer part of the loop goes up the indices slowly. The outer part of the loop. And then inside of that loop, I says, see if this index is 1. If it is, then we know that number is prime, because otherwise it would have been cleared or unset by one of the previous operations. So it starts with 2, which we know is prime. So you say, if the bit is 1, then you look at all multiples of that index value and clear the bits for all the multiples. So we kept 2 set, but we cleared 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, all of it. Then we increment to 3. 3 is still set, therefore 3 is prime, therefore we will clear all the multiples of 3. So we clear 6, 9, 12, so on, all the multiples of 3. And that is the loop structure. It's a double loop, so one loop inside of another loop. Now, there are some tricks you can deploy to make that slightly more efficient, but the question is, why does this work? Because at the end, what, you do this all the way through, and at the end, all the bits, all the indices whose bits are still set are prime numbers in that range. And here's the reasoning. Suppose that one of these numbers in that range is not prime. That number is divisible then by some prime number. And by the way, it's divisible by a prime number less than or equal to its own square root. Well, suppose you got an n. If n is not prime, then n is divisible by some prime. If p is prime. So it's a product of two other integers for p is prime. And if q is not prime, then it's divisible by primes and so on. So you can actually write this as a factorization of primes. Right? And what I claim is, if you take the smallest one of these primes, it's certainly got to be less than or equal to the square root of n. Because the smallest one of these, so you let b, let's just assume b is the smallest prime that divides n, and q is the product of all the ribs. Well then, I claim that b has to be less than or equal to q, because q is the product of all the other primes that divide n, and b was the smallest. So, the square root of n is a number such that what you have multiplied by itself is n, right? So that square root has to be bigger than or equal to p, because p is less than or equal to q, and p times q is n. So, all right, so let me go back. If a number is not prime, it's divisible by a prime, and in fact it's divisible by a prime that's less than or equal to the square root of that number. So that means that, forget about the square root for a minute, that means that this number's bit has to have been cleared by one of those loops that cleared the bits of all the multiples of the primes. And in fact, I could have just done that I could have stopped the outer loop of that clearing operation when it got up to be the square root of the number of bits in this bit vector, because clearing, not clearing, just considering the primes less than or equal to the square root of that largest number will be sufficient to get them all. So here's the layout we're going to be stated a little bit more formal. Begin with the bit vector index from 0 to n. Initialize by setting all the bits. Clear b of 0 and b of 1 because they're 0 and 1 are not prime. The k between 2 and the square root of n, that's using that square root operation. Step size 1, in other words, 4. If you want to make a for loop for k, 4 k equal to k less than or equal to n plus plus k. That's the way to write that for loop. If b of k, b is a bit vector. B, and of course I'm writing it here as though it were an array. But of course, you can't do it this way. But if the k bit is set, then for j between k plus k and n, step size k, clear that bit. This is the part about clearing all the multiples of one that you discovered is prime. Every time you run across a prime, you clear all of its multiples in the rest of the bit vector. You keep riding up through the bit vector like that. When you get up to the square root of the size of the bit vector, then you can stop. Okay, so that is the sieve process, and the theorem is that after the sieve process, the indices with set bits are prime numbers, and the indices with cleared or unset bits are not prime numbers. So that's the algorithm. Procedure requirements, work in your homework 2 directory, begin by copying live slash submit scripts slash HW2 submit SH into your assignment directory and change its permissions to executable. Create the two files, civ.cpp and makefile, and then turn in those two files using the submit script. Finally, down to the technical requirements. File civ.cpp should contain two functions, void civ and int main. Note that void civ takes an FSU bit vector by reference, not const reference, by the way. So that takes it by reference, which means that if you operate on that BV, it's being changed in the calling program. So that's just what you want. So this allows civ, the function civ, to go through precisely that civ Veritas-Lenz algorithm. And when it returns, of course it doesn't return back, but when it returns a throw back to main, BV will have had that process done through. And so all main's got to do is make a loop that outputs the indices whose bits are set, and doesn't output the indices whose bits are not set. So what I want you to do, in other words, is isolate the civ of Eratosthenes algorithm in this function. So encapsulate it in that function. And that function does no IO, it doesn't interact with the user or anything. All it does is a bit vector comes in and it does the civ of Eratosthenes of that bit vector. And then it's over. What main does is query the user to enter a number. It might output some sort of explanation about what it's doing before that. Then it queries the user for a number, reads that number. Then it creates a bit vector of the appropriate size, which as I point out to you, would be one more than the number the user entered. And then it's got to hand that bit, then it makes the call to civ, where it does civ on that bit vector. And then it does a loop that simply outputs all these set, all indices of set bits. And that main is over. Now, the one subtlety here, how can you know what size bit vector to make in your source code? You can't, because the size of the bit vector you have to make is being entered by the user. So, what that means is, you've got to create that bit vector with operator view after the user enters the parameter. Okay, so let's say I've said everything I need to say. Function civ takes a bit vector object by reference and forms the civ algorithm on it. So that when the function returns, bits of BV are set if and only if the index of the bit is prime. It's a function only, it does not do any interaction with users or anything with files. Function main should handle the IO, query the user for a project manager, and output a list of all primes that are less than or equal to the end. Then I want you to write a makefile that creates files, bitvac.o, sieve.o, and one executable sieve.x. Your make files create bitvac.o directly from the course library, directory days, without copying the source code into your project. There's a couple hints there. First one's telling you that an executable is distributed in Area 54, and the other one is telling you a hint about your make file. Okay, question about that? That's due next week. Questions or comments? Let me tell you where we are then. If you look up the calendar, we want to talk about chapter 3 today, and if I have time, I'm going to also talk about chapter 4. I'd really love to get ahead. If I got ahead, it won't mean we cover more material, it'll just mean we finish early. But it'll really be helpful to get through stuff fast. It just helps you get your projects done. First of all, give us time to work on projects during class. Secondly, you have more knowledge earlier to get projects done. Anyway, so chapter 3 is going to talk about strings, and it's going to introduce, it's going to review the situation with respect to string, C strings, and then introduce a string object class. It's an FSU library, and that string class you may use, you may also use the SED library string object class if you want to. Then next time, or the next chapter is on hashing, and I just want to talk briefly about hash functions, and then briefly about templates. So the two real short chapters that for some of you, for 33 last semester, both of those will be reviews. But not everybody will do that, of course. I'm going to go over those. Then I'm going to talk about vectors, which will be your first so-called container class, of course. We'll talk about vector objects, and I have some text reading. It's optional, but you might find helpful for vectors. I have some more for lists here. I'll put in for some other things. Once I've got hashing and vectors talked about, then you will have enough under your belt to discuss project one, which is a password server project. That will be due middle of February. February 13th. We want to then take kind of a tangential route, talk about algorithms a little bit. We're going to talk about sequential search and binary search algorithms. We'll talk about algorithm complexity, how do you measure, or how do you compare the runtime of two algorithms, and so on. So that'll give us some search algorithms. It'll also give us some vocabulary to talk about runtime of things, which will be necessary. Then we'll go back to our container construction. This next one we'll build will be a list container, and that's what Chapter 8 is about. The third one we'll build is a deck container, and that's what Chapter 9 is about. And Chapter 10 is abstract data types, where we'll study ADTs in general, and we'll study stacks, and we'll study queues, and that will be the last formal thing before midterm exam. Going back to the project side, password server project is going to use vectors and binary search. So binary search is in Chapter 7 here. And so it was a little bit of a problem. So I'm wondering, I'm kind of hoping to get a little bit ahead. Project 2 is basically using techniques for lists, linked list structures, to make something called a ring buffer. Project 3 is called a wrap pack, and it's going to use stacks and queues to control search algorithms to simulate the solution of a maze. And so the week before spring break, we have a midterm, then we have spring break. Then we come back. You might look out and get this done before you leave. Function objects, iterators, generic algorithms. And I have a homework that's all just an extra, like a weightlifting exercise involving function objects. And then we'll talk about tables, in particular hash tables. And I'm going to give you the internet router assignment, which is project 4. It uses hash tables. And then finally, we'll talk about heaps. And I'll give you a homework assignment related to heaps, which I'll talk about priority queues. I hope y'all noticed that this the plan is to be completely through new material at least 2 weeks before in the semester. It'd be nice to get finished even earlier than that, so we can meet, talk about getting these, all these projects. Project four and homework four are both pretty, non-trivial projects, so, you absolutely cannot get behind on your project deadlines here, so that will be a disaster for you if that happens. Okay, so let's go back to no questions about calendar, let's go for bid vectors or homework two. Let's start talking about streams. So what we're going to do is critique C strings and talk about the need for a proper type and then introduce the string quiz. C strings, as you know, are just pointers to type care. It's a clever device that's been around since the early days of computing. The way a C string works is there's a special character called the null character, represented in C++ and in C by the \0 symbol. It does have an ASCII code. It is a genuine character, but of course it represents nothing. It's sort of the Seinfeld character. And it's not something you want to output to a screen, because when you tell the screen to do nothing, sometimes the screen does something anyway that you don't expect. So it's not a character you want to try to output, but it is a character. So what C did is build up a way of handling strings. And of course, strings are important because they represent words, right? And data, numbers are at the core of strings. Number representation of strings. And the whole language of computing and everyday life is built around strings. And so obviously, computer programs have to be able to deal with these things. And C developed a way of doing it, which is actually pretty clever. What C does is say, okay, I'll have a pointer to type care. Now, that means that you've got some address in memory. And the fact that it's a pointer to type care means that the pointer knows that it's pointing to an object that occupies one byte only, one byte of memory. Now, then what makes this work in C is that there's an agreement that strings, that the end of the string, the beginning of the string will be denoted by the pointer, which tells you the address of its first character. The end of the string will be the null symbol character. And so you'll have a data-dependent notion of how you get to the end of the string. But that way, if you assume strings have this property, they're well-formed, then you can devise algorithms to deal with strings. For example, you can compute the length of a string by just starting at the 0 element for that pointer and keep counting until you get to a null character, and that count is the number of characters in the string, for example. The problems with this, though, were unanticipated when C was designed, but now with kind of a modern view of how things can go bad, we see that there's a couple problems with that. Namely, these hidden assumptions that have to be enforced by human energy and aren't enforced by computation. So if someone forgets to null terminate a string and hand it to one of these algorithms, and that algorithm is going to overrun the end of that memory that was allocated to that string and keep going until some null character in the memory or somewhere is encountered. The second hidden assumption is that memory has in fact been allocated. So just because you have a pointer to some type doesn't mean that it owns any memory. And so these turn out to be both significant area pitfalls for crashing programs, for even security breaches of various kinds. And so they've been kind of notoriously difficult to deal with for a long time. And you still have to deal with strings. You can't get away from them, but the general recommendation in C++ is to use them as little as possible. And when you do use them, of course, be very careful to make sure that those two hidden assumptions are true, are verified. The reason you have to keep using strings is that, just legacy code. Even the open member function for an OF stream in C++ requires a char star variable to carry the file. It doesn't require a string on it, it requires a care starter. And so, you know, it's just, you can't get away from C-strings. But when you get in any kind of serious manipulation, you definitely want to go to string objects instead. So here is a possible, here's a way that the output operator could be written for a string, a C-string. This would be, this is effectively the way the output operator is loaded for a C-string. So the idea is you want to output this C-string str, and of course it's just a pointer, but you assume that memory's been allocated and the string's been terminated. So what you do is you dereference that string pointer. You don't see that one on highlight? So, you see that or is it blocked out? Okay. Is it disconcerting? Would you rather me not highlight? Okay. You dereference that string pointer, which gives you the character that it's pointing to, and you ask if it's, well, you test it to see if it's equal to this null character, and if it's not, then you put that character into the string and then increment the pointer. Remember, incrementing a pointer just moves to the next memory location, the next footprint, the next memory location, considering the type of the pointer. Now, this particular pointer is a type char, so it's pointing only a single byte, so that would literally, in this case, move one address up in memory. And then do it again. So you keep out the character and you get to the null set. There's some rhetorical questions here. How is the assumption of null termination used? Well, it's to make the loop quit, right? How is the assumption of memory allocation used? Well, when you do this, you assume you're operating in memory that's been assigned to your running program or been loaned to you legitimately by some other running program. And that's the assumption of memory development. Now here, if memory hasn't been allocated, it's sort of not going to do any harm. Remember, where it does real harm when memory's not allocated is when you're inputting a string and writing over stuff. So here's a possible implementation of strcpy, which if you recall, copies right-hand string to the left-hand string. Notice, and this is another member of the string.h library, strcpy. Notice what that's going to do is, dereference str1, which is the one on the right, and see if that its character value is null. If it's not, it's going to copy that character value to the character value on the left string, and then increment both pointers. You may be thinking, well, how come you can increment that pointer? Because you said const here. Const char star associates like this. So when you say const char star, you mean I want a pointer to constant char. So that means that the thing the pointer points to is not going to be allowed to be changed. This pointer itself can't change. And of course, we're not going to change what this points to because we're using it on the right-hand side of the assignment, not the left-hand side of the assignment. The one here is being passed in with no const, and so the thing, the stuff it points to will be allowed to be changed, and that's exactly what's wrong. Now this, if, let's see, the assumption that str1 is null terminated is used implicitly, clearly. The assumption that str2 is going to allocate sufficient memory is used implicitly, right? Because you're writing over that memory by incrementing that pointer. So if that memory hasn't been allocated, you're writing over something else's memory. It could be anything. It could be part of the machine code that you're running programming cause a crash and the thing was or not. By the way, note that the very last thing that happens is that the null character is placed at the end of str2. And that's legitimate. That happens in the strcpy algorithm. So these two, str2 and str1, str2 has to have at least as many characters allocated as str1. And that's one more than the number that's in the actual word you're trying to represent, because you have to have that extra character for the null character at the end. So, we have the concept of proper type. It should be responsible for its own data, meaning that it keeps the data protected from client tampering and keep the data protected from other programs. I guess that's redundant because the client is another program. Type should be responsible for its own behavior, so if you want to document the behavior, make the behavior available to clients, and implement the behavior separately out of public view. and the tax payer is responsible for its own existence. When a client needs a variable of property type, asking for it should be enough. It shouldn't have to be a lot of worry about, well, did the memory get allocated for this variable? And when a client's finished with the variable, it should go away peacefully. In other words, when it goes out of scope, it should not cause a memory problem in any way. So if the C++ class captures this notion of property type, class objects are responsible for their own data, keep the data in the non-public area of the class, and control access to the data through public methods. Class objects are responsible for their own behavior, document behavior in the public methods, and keep the implementation and performance of the interface. And finally, they're responsible for their own existence, so the class has appropriate constructors and destructors, and the assignment operator and copy constructor are appropriately implemented. So one of these things then will be a property type. So what we want to do is make string objects that are property types, so we can handle them, so we can handle strings as easily as we handle ints. We don't have to worry about null termination, we don't have to worry about allocating.